This Is Money's podcast is brought to you in partnership with the Financial Services Compensation Scheme. Check your financial products at FSCS Protected at fscs.org.uk/thisismoney.
Welcome to This Is Money. I'm Georgie Frost, and alongside me and editor Simon Lambert today is assistant editor Lee Boyce. And how worried should we really be about coronavirus? I'm not talking about our health, but I'm talking specifically about our investments. Global stock markets already being impacted, so what can you do to protect your money? Also, we've a budget just round the corner, so Simon asks, will the new Chancellor be brave enough to get rid of Britain's 60p tax rate? Also, This Is Money help a couple get £25,000 worth of savings back after a nasty SIM swap scam. What is the most ridiculous thing you've been asked in an interview? And what is the most iconic car of all time? That is not, by the way, an interview question that I know of, although actually I don't think it would be a bad one. Bit more fun. Anyway, don't forget you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, coronavirus continues to spread around the world. You could join the throngs, if you so choose, on the tube by donning masks, lathering yourself in sanitizer gel, even self-isolating altogether. There is a rather helpful, I don't know if that's the right word, video on the BBC. Should you so want to have some tips on what Oh yes, Lee's head in hands right now. Anyone with a small child as well. Even more fun. However, you cannot stick a mask over your investments. Well, not really, metaphorically speaking, I suppose. But as the global stock markets tanked this week, businesses have been rushing to explain why they are affected. From Aston Martin saying less posh car sales and supply chain issues to Diageo, because of course we're not going to be going out and buying so much booze, apparently, and the more obvious candidates that you would expect, such as airlines and travel firms, which have already been hit. So how worried should we be, and is there really anything that we can do about it? First and foremost, I understand that you might be worried about coronavirus's impact on your health, but I should say that we are a finance podcast. We're not being unsympathetic to that issue, but we are going to focus instead, if that's all right, Simon. I don't think anyone here is a medical professional.
Well, I was going to say, unless there's something I don't know about the three of us in this room, I'm not sure that any of us have any official medical training.
Not at all. Yes, but what you do have training in is investments and money. So we're going to stick to that, shall we? And how worried we should be, because what's been happening this week? Let's start there, because anyone looking at their investments might sort of think, oh, that's not good. What's happened?
What has happened this week is the stock market has been absolutely tanking. It has been in, well, what has been described as freefall. The market is now down 15% from its peak that was reached on January the 17th, but 12% of that has come this week alone. At the point of recording this podcast, which is mid-morning on Friday. Now, it could be that we end today up, but the stock market opened down 200 points this morning and then was trading down 300 points. These are big falls. And there's an old saying, bull markets don't die of old age. Bull markets may not die of old age, but they might die of coronavirus. The stock market has been on an upward trend, punctuated by some corrections along the way, ever since just after the financial crisis, the recovery after that. And there has been a question for some time as to what will finally end that bull market, whether we were at the point where the bull market would end. Have we seen things like the melt-up, the final rise at the end, the euphoria that you would usually get, and all these other things? And the one thing that has repeatedly come up is this saying, bull markets don't die of old age. That this, what lies behind that is they don't just expire and mm-hmm. give up. Something happens. And the big concern for investors is that the something happens might be coronavirus. Why is everybody so worried about coronavirus? Not because of the face masks, not because of the hand gel, not necessarily because of the fatality rates, which, you know, it's very difficult to ascertain, but there's talk that this is not much more fatal than the normal flu. We get flu outbreaks all the time. But what has become clear is that attempts to stop the spread of the disease and people shying away from wanting to get it, trying to get it, are going to heavily impact the global economy. So what this is doing is this is affecting both supply and demand at the same time. Normally you get either a demand side shock or a supply side shock. So either demand suddenly drops or supply suddenly drops. What's happening at the moment is that the globalized economy is struggling because stuff can't move around quite as easily. So be that Aston Martin shipping parts around, sending cars off to China. Any number of companies have reported on this. And demand is dropping, from Diageo saying less people are going to go to the pub, so they're going to buy less of Diageo's big name alcohol brands, to EasyJet and BA, who are being absolutely hammered because obviously people are going to fly less. Mm-hmm. They're going to not book flights because they are worried about the spread of coronavirus, and they're going to not book flights because they're worried that they won't actually be able to go on them. And EasyJet and BA shares have been absolutely hammered this week, and at the time of recording this podcast, they were down 15% today. And the big concern for investors, and I don't want to overplay this, okay, but just to explain what's going on here, is the big concern for investors is that every correction we've seen in this bull market has been a sort of V-shaped one. Markets fall, eventually buying pressure comes in. People buying the dips, as it's called, because they're convinced that central banks had their back, money's going to stay cheap, that's going to keep asset prices inflated. I think now we have reached the point where people are going, hang on a minute, maybe this one isn't going to bounce back really quickly. Maybe there's going to be more bad news before there's better news. Maybe this isn't being overplayed at the moment. Maybe this isn't the moment of maximum fear, because it's the moment of maximum fear that the market's fallen the most, and that's when you should buy back in. So that, I think, is the reason why people are dumping shares all around the world and fleeing to safety. And I must admit that without wanting to overplay this, I've not seen anything like this since the financial crisis in terms of stock market falls and stock markets being hammered and the mood in the market. So who knows how this one plays out? It's very difficult to tell. You know, maybe we get a grip on it, the cases die down, and all of a sudden there is a bounce back, and this isn't the end of the bull market. But to a lot of people, this looks like the thing that might do it, and people are rushing to what they consider safe havens. So gold has gone up, and government bond yields have fallen, and the prices of government bonds have risen as people chuck their money into the supposed safe haven of things like UK gilts, US Treasury bonds.
Forgive me, Simon. Is it a case then, as you're saying, we're in the middle of a bull market, prices were going up, people were sort of expecting at some stage it's going to die. I hate using that terminology, but okay. And this is almost a perfect storm. So actually, were, say, coronavirus to hit, I don't know, a few years back, we probably wouldn't be experiencing quite the reaction that we're getting now. Is that what we're saying? That perhaps people were thinking, oh, this was the inevitable anyway, and thus investors are fleeing elsewhere? Or is this, could you absolutely say that the extent to which it's fallen, the 15%, the 12% this week alone, is due to coronavirus? Or are there other factors at play here, being the fact it was perhaps overpriced?
The thing that moves markets is greed and fear. And greed sends them up, fear sends them down. I know what you mean about the language around it, but don't feel too sorry, for that poor bull, because the beauty of markets is that there's reincarnation. So the bull market gets reincarnated as a bear market when the market is falling, and then eventually the bear market will end and get reincarnated as a bull. It swings around, it goes up and down. You know, you've got some pretty roasty valuations. You've had some fairly toppy things going on. Look at the massive rise in the US tech giants' share prices. Look at what happened to Tesla's share price in recent months. It went completely bananas. You could map it over the top of a chart of Bitcoin, and they didn't look too different. So there has been euphoric behaviour. But you're right, people are looking out for this one. They're looking for the thing that ends the bull market, and they are worried. Now, the thing is that's all very well, you know, talking about the soap opera of the markets, but what do you do as an individual investor?
Same old advice that you would do, ride it out?
don't panic.
Yeah,
it is the answer. You know, essentially, it's not a good idea to be selling when markets are down 15%. No. Now they could keep falling. Okay, so
do you expect that to be likely, or
I don't know?
We just don't know.
I don't know. I can't predict the future.
Obviously.
But I think that people do need to be aware when they're told it's not a good idea to sell when markets are down 15%, that they could end up down 30%. So, you know, I don't want someone saying to me, well, I listened to your podcast in February, on February the 28th, and you said, don't sell when markets are down 15%, and then they ended up down 30%, and you're an idiot. So that is the case.
But say that anyway,
you know, but
Simon.
I've got an investment portfolio. I look at it and I think, well, would have been great if I'd have moved to the safety of cash, you know, at the start of January when this first started to raise its head, and then I'd have had the cash there ready to buy in when the market's fallen more and hopefully make a profit. But in all reality, for most people, that is not how their investments work. I mean, if you've got 20 different things in your portfolio of funds and shares and things like that, for a start, it's extremely time-consuming and expensive to sell all of those things. And then where do you put the money? And then what happens if actually the market doesn't fall and it goes up and you've cost yourself some money? This is why people are told to not try to time the markets, because it's very, very difficult to do. Even the world's most renowned investors come unstuck regularly on it. And I can think of a big name investor who came unstuck recently. Okay?
Can you?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Betting that the market was wrong and he was right. Neil Woodford, for anybody who doesn't realise what I'm talking about. And then there's always that saying, oh, well, it's timing in the market. Well, what does that mean? Well, how long are you going to be invested for? So I'm going to hold my investments for the next 20, 30 years, probably. So there's no point trying to ditch them now and try to time the market. The place where this is an issue is for people who will need that money in the short term. Perhaps they're approaching retirement. If your pension takes a hit when you're approaching retirement, perhaps they're already retired, because lots of investors now retire with their pension still invested and then they draw an income from it, rather than buying an annuity like they used to in the old days, or rather than getting one of those wonderful final salary pensions that people used to get in the old days. Again, the advice there from the experts is to try to avoid selling when markets are down. If you are relying on that money, because what you want to do is wait for that to go back up. And it's a bit late to say this, but what you really need to be doing is looking at your investments and deciding whether they suit you, whether you're taking the right amount of risk. Because whilst the market is down 15%, not everything's going to be down 15%.
There are more. Those companies must be doing an absolute killing.
Well,
right,
exactly.
Now.
I mean, yeah. And there is one company that
hand sanitizers are sold out. Yeah, in Boots, apparently.
Yeah, exactly. So the government's giving people the government's saying to people, wash your hands and get some alcohol based hand gel. Try to get your hands on some alcohol based hand gel at the moment, or some face masks. You know, this is what they should probably be doing. Is trying to sort this out. But I guess there's probably a global shortage of alcohol-based hand sanitizer at the moment. You know, we just don't knock enough of it around. But back to the investment thing. The answer is don't panic, because the worst thing you can do is just suddenly do something very, very suddenly, very, very quickly. But, yeah, you need to make sure that your investments are right for you, and it's probably too late to do that this time. But if you are, you know, in that approaching retirement or in retirement or whatever, and you're seeing that you've got lots of riskier investments that are being hammered even more than the market at the moment, you know, with the best will in the world saying this, those are the wrong type of investments to be holding. And also the other thing is, if you do have some cash, maybe at some point when the market's down enough, you want to think about buying in, because the thing about the market, as I said, they get reincarnated. The bear market turns back into a bull market.
Well, so that's investors, Lee, and thank you for sitting there very patiently. But what about consumers? What about people who perhaps have got some holidays booked, perhaps people thinking about going to the Olympics, all those sorts of things? Where do we all stand?
First, I've got to say, George, this has been some hysteria around this coronavirus. I mean, seeing those flashing stock market red signs, all those screens, it has been a while since we've seen that all come into play. And it's one of those things, I feel like it's got a Hollywood beginning, as in it's got a backstory. You know, is it, has it come from a bat? Has it come from a snake? All this kind of thing. And it feeds into people.
Apparently.
And it feeds into all of these sort of like fears people have of like a global virus. And then we start seeing stock markets crash, et cetera, et cetera. And it's been a crazy old time. Now, I'm affected by this in the fact that I am off to Italy in 2 and a bit weeks' time. And the official advice from the airline that I'm flying with, which is Ryanair, is, of course, that flights are operating as normal. And what you consumers have to do is look at the Foreign Office advice. If there are countries in which you are advised not to travel unless it is essential, then you need to contact your airline. That includes if you were flying somewhere, say like Australia, and there's a stopover in China, the likelihood is you're going to have some sort of impact on that flight. But very few travel insurance policies are going to cover you for this kind of event. And it means there's a trade-off now between what you can do. You either write off some of the cash and go, well, you can't go, you don't want to risk it, you're just going to have to sort of say, well, that's gone. Or you still go ahead and travel. And that's the kind of dilemma I'm personally in at the moment. So I'm meant to be flying out in a couple of weeks' time. Travel insurance isn't going to cover us. The flights are £300-400. We've booked, one of the saving graces of it is that we've booked some of our accommodation with booking.com. Some of it is through Airbnb. They have quite loose cancellation policies. You can cancel up to a day or two before. So we'd get that money back. That's fine. And that is actually the nature, saving grace of how some people book their holidays now. But the flights will likely be a write-off. Now, I'm very much on for just keep calm and carry on when it comes to investments, but also when it comes to your own life. And I think if we went around worrying all the time about all the different things that might happen to us, we'd never do anything. But this is how crises like this unfold, because Italy, you know, it damages the tourism. People don't want to go there. They do go there. They don't go and do anything. They're not spending the money. And it starts to have a downward spiral across the world. Mm-hmm. And it shows you how linked, you know, and how reliant some countries are on things like tourism. And it just has a knock-on effect. And the thing is, Georgie, as you said at the start, I mean, I get the tube every day. It's thousands of people. I don't sit on the tube and think, oh, what if someone's got coronavirus on this tube? It's... I mean, what would you do?
You'd never go out, would you?
You'd never go out. But, of course, what's happening is, again, the globalisation of everywhere is that there's been lots of knock-on effects on, you know, suppliers and all that kind of thing that go from big corporate massive chains all the way down to little guys that might be seeing, you know, their supply chain completely knocked out because of, you know, staff shortages in Chinese factories because people aren't going into work because they're on lockdown. You know, and this stuff just it just evolves and evolves and evolves into what we're seeing this week, which is this full panic mode from, you know, markets, from people. The way I see it, what have we got in this country at the moment? 19 confirmed cases. Feels like it's been weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks of talking about this virus. And I'm not playing it down. We're not medical
it's
experts.
Hard. Well, no, it's really hard, isn't it? Because you don't want to say anything.
Man wills on coronavirus. No, come on then, have a go.
Let's have a look at you. But you know what I'm trying to say? It's kind of like, you know, if I wandered around worrying all the time about getting a strain of the flu, yeah. I wouldn't leave the house. No one would do anything.
No, absolutely. Why? It's really hard to make any comment because I'm the same. I don't want to. I'm quite sort of laissez-faire about things. And I said this, and you know, there'll be some 28 days later thing going on. But you know, it doesn't help anyone having that attitude. Just be sensible, as you would.
Just be sensible. I can't believe we're having to have warnings and videos about how to wash your hands properly. Yeah.
The self-isolation video just did it for me.
Well,
I mean,
I'm going to go to Italy. Simon's kindly said I can have 2 weeks of self-isolation when I get back. I'm sure work will really appreciate that. I can't believe the agio I was saying. Sales are going down. So I'll just get down to the supermarket, get myself a couple of cases of beers in. Lovely.
Yeah,
2 weeks, ride it out. You know, I'm doing my thing to make sure I'm not a super spreader.
Things like stuck on a cruise or stuck in Tenerife. You know, there's worse places to be stuck.
Well,
obviously we're not playing
this now. Say that. You say that, but everybody said that, and then the people in Tenerife said that they'd all been shut in their rooms and handed a sandwich through the door on the first day, and you suddenly thought, ooh,
prison.
Actually, that doesn't sound that good. A hotel in Tenerife that I'm stuck in the room. And then,
fortunately,
the next day they all got let out. And so you had those wonderful pictures of people sunbathing, bikinis and face masks, which I thought was absolutely hilarious.
That'd be awful tan lines, wouldn't it?
And also, just to put the stock market thing into context, okay? So there was a bigger fall than this in the middle of this
you know, sort of bull market yeah. periods post the financial crisis. Between April 2015 and February 2016, the market fell 22%.
Mm-hmm.
And it did bounce back from that. So, you know, just to put that in context. And then big falls other than that, 2007 to 2009, that was the financial crisis. That was 47%. The dot-com bust was 50%. The dot-com bust one actually does deliver an interesting statistic, though. The FTSE 100 is the stock market that has gone nowhere in 20 years. December 30th, 1999, 6930. Today, 6530. Mm. The stock market is below where it was 20 years ago. So you can see why people are put off investing. But there's two important things to remember here. One, throughout quite a bit of that period, it has been substantially higher than that. So you could have made money. And two, that's not the total return, because the total return, you have to take into account dividends. And if you take into account the dividends that you would have been paid out by holding the shares in that index, then you would have had a return that would have comfortably beaten what you would have got on cash and inflation as well, actually. So that's the important thing to remember, and highlights just how important dividends and reinvested dividends are to stock market returns over time.
All right, we're going to put that to one side. Another big event coming around the corner, though, which we're going to talk about now, is the budget. Lots of speculation about what might be in it. It does look like the rumoured scrapping of the current higher rate pension tax relief is off the table after some unsurprising outcry from Tory MPs. But Simon is asking, will the new Chancellor be brave enough to introduce a measure that will actually explicitly help the wealthy? So you've been penning your latest piece on why you think Britain should get rid of the 60p tax rate. But before we get to the whys, our rather more astute listeners might be thinking, hang on a minute, I thought the top rate was 45p. What are you talking about, Simon?
OK, so the top rate of tax in this country is officially 45p, above £150,000. And for a brief period of time, it was 50p. And there was a huge outcry about that. That was very controversial. The problem is, the real top rate of income tax in this country is actually 60p. And it was 60p throughout that 50p period, and it's been 60p throughout this 45p period. Why is that? Because when people earn more than £100,000, they have their personal allowance removed from them at a rate of £1 for every £2 that they earn,
mm-hmm.
or 50p for every pound is an easier way to understand it. The personal allowance is £12,500, so over a £25,000 bracket, you lose the money at that rate. The effect this has on your tax rate on the next pound that you earn is that it adds 50% to it. So the tax rate goes from 40% to 60%. So people earning £100,000 to £125,000 actually pay 60% income tax. Now, I should say here that I am not going to make an attempt to get people to feel sorry for people earning over £100,000. However many stories you may read of these poor high earners who've got high costs and they just can't keep up, even though they're on £100,000 a year, they are rich. By any measure, they are rich. They are very well paid.
Mm-hmm.
However, they are not as rich as people who earn more than them. They're not as rich as the people earning £150,000 a year plus. They're not even as rich as the people earning £125,000 a year plus. So why on earth do we make them pay more tax? This quirk of the tax system was introduced by then-Chancellor Alistair Darling as part of emergency measures brought in during the financial crisis. But we've had four Tory chancellors in a row who lambast the Labour Party as the party of high tax, the party that doesn't reward work, the party that doesn't reward entrepreneurship, and so on and so on and so on. And every single one of those chancellors has been the Chancellor of the Exchequer whilst Britain has a 60p tax rate. Now, there are far more pressing things to be dealt with in the budget. I am, you know, ranging from this whole levelling up agenda to getting, you know, the North up and back on track a bit more. But social care, homelessness, in-work poverty, universal credit, all of these things are very important. However, if you find a place in the tax code that is treating people unfairly, you should just get rid of it. And this bit of the tax code does treat people unfairly. A tax should be perceived to be fair by the people who are paying it and the population at large. It should be simple, and so on and so on. And this isn't. And I think that Rishi Sunak will sit down, or stand up actually, won't he, to deliver his budget on March 11th. And he has got his best shot at a blank sheet of paper budget. They've got a big majority. Yes, there will be accusations that they're helping the wealthy and so on and so on. But it is high time that Britain got rid of its 60p tax rate. Now, what I would say is that I wrote about this before in the run-up to the election, and I think maybe we might have discussed it, because Labour had plans to overhaul the income tax system and introduce a 45p tax band above £80,000. But they weren't going to get rid of the personal allowance removal, so that would have actually meant a top rate of tax of 67.5%. However, the Labour Party at least had the decency to answer the question. The Tories ignored our questions three times. Just didn't reply.
That's there you quite go. Typical at the moment.
It is, isn't it? You know, three times we specifically said, are you going to get rid of this? Just no answer. Not a no, but just no answer. As I said, you know, they lambast the Labour Party as the party of high tax and everything like that. But since George Osborne has been in charge, we've had Conservative chancellors with a 60p tax rate that they could have got rid of. And it's high time that we got shot of it.
Will he?
Who knows? I mean, the thing is as well, so my argument for this would be that those people earning that amount of money are probably going to go on to earn more money. And as they go on to earn more money, we want them to pay more tax. So it's a really bad idea to treat people so unfairly on their way up, because it just gets their backs up. And everybody that I've ever spoken to who is affected by this gets really knocked off about it. And I do think that you should not be in a position where you don't get to keep at least 50% of the next pound that you earn.
All right, well, we shall see. We shall see. We're going to move on because we know that using your phone abroad can be expensive, but I think this next piece rather takes the biscuit, I think. A couple of This Is Money readers, who are a couple, had £25,000 of their savings swiped while travelling in South America. Now, they're blaming the phone company because one of their phone numbers was ported without their consent, and the pair say that three are effectively helping facilitate this so-called SIM swap scam by not taking security seriously enough. So, Lee, the scam man Boyce, fill us in on the story and the details. What is a SIM swap scam?
So, Georgia, we've had a couple of cases, quite big cases, in the last few months around this. We had a couple that we had one reader actually who lost £80,000 before Christmas in a similar kind of scam. Again, three were involved in that. And this time around, it's £25,000. So, what a SIM swap scam essentially is, and how this scam essentially works, is fraudsters want to port your telephone number away. So they want to get your mobile number first. That's what they want to do. They want to take over your mobile number. And they do that by requesting a PAC code from your mobile operator. So if you wanted to switch providers, you want to switch operators, you'd request a PAC code. Things have got much easier than they used to be because of new rules around this. So you should get your PAC code pretty quickly, and you should be able to move and port your telephone number over to another rival pretty quickly. In the past, it was actually hard to keep hold of your mobile number, but this is to be encouraged switching and competition, etc. Now, what you need to change your PAC code, get your PAC code and keep your phone number, is some personal information that obviously you should only know. And some of this information includes name, address, all that kind of thing, date of birth, but also things like the last four digits of your debit card and other personal information that you should only know and you would expect to only know. However, fraudsters, of course, as we know, are a bunch of people that manage to get personal information from people. This can be from all sorts of methods, things like the dark web, where your personal information might be up for sale for a couple of quid, and they can use this to then facilitate bigger scams and to hook, to basically hook in cash from people by tricking banks into making transfers of cash away. So in this case, fraudsters managed to pass the checks with three, get the PAC code, move a telephone number over, take control of that telephone number, use that telephone number to then access online banking. Of course, a lot of us have been pushed onto using banking apps, to make our lives easier. And they've managed to transfer £25,000 out of Revolut and Lloyds accounts into a number of accounts elsewhere, which is a common fraudster tactic, like to move money, especially abroad, because it becomes very hard to trace once money moves abroad. There's not police, it's out of the jurisdiction. There's not much the police can do about it. But this couple were then left in limbo while travelling in South America. So you can imagine how stressful this is. And you might have saved for this trip. To me, it sounds like they're using Revolut as a place to spend abroad, because it has, it's one of the perks of a Revolut account and some of these challenger banks, and challenger wasn't a bank but a challenger provider, is to use it for cheaper fees overseas. So you're in the middle of perhaps a dream holiday, and you're having to deal with not having £25,000 worth of cash, and it is stressful. I mean, I can imagine, only imagine how much that has impacted their trip, because even if you go, right, we've got the ball rolling, we're going to forget about it and enjoy this trip, it's always going to be nagging in the back of your mind about that money and knowing that it's gone. And it took quite a long time for the money to be refunded by Revolut. A lot of it was waiting for Three to basically confirm that it was a fraudulent move and that the number shouldn't have been moved across. And it actually admitted to us in the other case that it made mistakes and that the money, that the PAT code shouldn't have been moved across. And actually the Ombudsman got involved in that one and ruled in favour of the customer, and they were required to pay out a compensation and write a letter of apology. It has told us that it's making these checks stricter and that it's made changes to stop this from happening in the future. But it's worrying, isn't
Absolutely.
It? To think that someone could impersonate you to get your phone number, and you think, well, what does that really matter that much? But then what they then use your phone number to do, I think it's a scary time we live in, Georgie. And it's just one of the many scams that you have to be fully aware of.
Are you as critical of three as this couple are? Do you think there is more that they can do? And are they going to do it? Because it's all very well saying that actually, yes, you know, lessons will be learned. But what are you actually going to do about it?
Well, I just think that the checks need to be far, far stricter. Yes, we are living in a time in which we are used to living, you know, fast and furious. We want to be able to, like, move our bank account, our products, financial products, our mobile number as quickly as possible. And a lot of moves in recent years have facilitated this to make our lives easier and to do this. And 99.999% of the time, a PAT code request is kind of just done, and it's used for the purpose that it's meant to be used for, to move your phone number over to another provider as quickly as possible. But I don't like the thought of someone being able to phone up my mobile provider and trick them into handing over the PAT code. I mean, how could that even happen?
Yeah.
Yes, you might have a few personal bits of information about me, but surely there needs to be a few more hoops to jump. Now, we've singled out Three in these two stories because that's who's got in touch with us. This happened to be Three customers. It might be happening to other people who are with other mobile operators. We just don't know. We haven't had any other cases in from rivals, so it's hard to know the full scale of this type of fraud. But the thing is, criminal fraudsters, all they have to do is be successful once or twice over the course of a year in this kind of thing, and they've, you know, banked a nice amount of money
that
gets probably filtered away to funding crime elsewhere, or, you know, wherever else it heads. And I think financial firms, mobile providers, telecoms, utilities firms all have a responsibility to keep their customers safe. As I say, I do have a slight degree of sympathy in the fact that, you know, these companies are expected now to release this kind of information pretty quickly, and that can, I would argue, potentially lead into some mistakes. But surely there must be stricter ways of allowing this to be moved across. That's what it plays up in my mind. And if money like this is being lost, I mean, a bank like Revolut or Lloyds that were involved in this having to then refund that money when it's gone, it's kind of, you know, and we've got this fraud fund that all these banks are squabbling over about push payment scams and actual blameless victimless crimes in which it's not your fault that you've lost your money, and they're squabbling over this fraud pot that again has been pushed back. What's going to be done with that? And it's going to be there till the end of the year. But it's costing banks money to do this, and anything we can do to stamp down on any type of fraud, for me, needs to be made.
Absolutely. All right. Do you remember the days when you'd go into an interview, guys? A long time ago, though, to be fair. A tougher question would be things like, where do you see yourself in 5 years, or The one that really gets people is, do you have any questions for us? That's a tough one. But nowadays you can be asked anything from golf balls on planes. There's a new movie in that. Fighting horse-sized ducks and what a penguin would say walking into a room. But how on earth do you go about answering these questions? What's the weirdest question you guys have ever been asked? You start there.
I don't think I've ever been asked a weird question in an interview, actually.
Really? Okay.
Well, I haven't had a job interview in a long time.
I was going to say, it's been a while. How long have you been at This Is Money for? Like, well over a decade, right?
14 years. 15 years.
Wow.
What year are we in? 2020?
that says it all.
Who am I? That was interview question.
Where am I? Yeah. Who am I? Lee, have you had a weird one?
To be honest, I haven't had a job interview for a very long time because I've been here for a decade. So I've never been anywhere trendy or upstart enough to kind of ask one of those wacky questions.
It's either sort of trendy startup companies, as Lee said, or you get it from some of these ones on the sort of graduate round, don't you? The graduate recruitment thing where someone thinks that they're quite smart and they're going to ask the question.
I mean, this was a while ago, but I'm terrible at this, right? Because I'd straight bat it back. So someone asked me once, what makes you a better candidate than all the other ones? And I said, I don't know, I've not met the other ones. Okay, on reflection, perhaps I could have answered that a bit more in my favour, but what a silly question. And the other one was, what am I thinking? And I was like, I don't know. You've been asking me all the questions for the last, like, half an hour.
Well, that's sort of like, what are you thinking right now?
What am I thinking?
Nobody likes that question.
What a stupid question.
People always lie to that. You get that question sometimes in your personal life, don't you? When you're sat there and your partner goes, what are you thinking about?
He wasn't asking me what I was thinking.
What I'm thinking about.
But he wasn't asking me what I was thinking. He was saying to me, what do you think that I am thinking?
What do you think I'm thinking right now?
So like you would be saying to me, you know, so Georgie, what am I thinking? I don't know. You've been asking me the questions for the last half an hour.
You'd look good in a bikini and a face mask.
Right? Thanks.
That's not what I'm thinking, by the way. I was just dragging up a joke from earlier in the podcast.
I'm going to leave the studio.
On that note, look, we've got an article on your website. This is ridiculous. We've got an article on your website, though. This is why we're talking about
it. If your interview, you get asked one of those strange questions and your interview manages to descend into the fact that you're all laughing about it, your interview has gone well. You've then connected with that person. So
unless you start a hashtag
me too. If you have come out of an interview this week and it did end up sounding like this, don't panic.
Yeah.
You're probably more likely to get the
start.
Job.
Absolutely. I noticed on Twitter, because we were talking about interview questions, and one lady was complaining because, I mean, this is not a weird interview question, but it was something that annoys a lot of people, that she was asked in the interview, how much are you currently earning? Which I know that people trying to get rid of the gender pay gap don't really like. But then we saw your article come out about weird interview questions, and it seems a good topic to talk about. How do you answer the kind of the more obscure ones, not like I did, or the ones that you genuinely don't believe you should have to answer without looking difficult?
So look, what are people looking for when they ask these questions? Okay, we've got a couple of recruitment experts who gave us some comment here. And one of them said, you know, sometimes, you know, they're just asking a question to be mean or nasty. Mm. And the other one said, also, you've got to bear in mind that sometimes they're asking a question because they want to see you think on your feet. They want to see your ability to deal with things as they come up. So there is no correct answer to the question of would you rather fight a horse-sized duck or 100 duck-sized horses. But what they're looking for is for you to think and give an answer that shows that you've reflected on it. Mm. So would you rather fight a horse-sized duck or 100 duck-sized horses? Okay, my answer is that I would rather fight a horse-sized duck because if you think about the power of lots of little things that work together and team up, then it can be quite dramatic. I mean, look at what ants manage to do. They're all tiny. I reckon you'd be better off fighting a horse-sized duck. Also, drawing on my knowledge of Hollywood movies, I saw the Ghostbusters defeat the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man, whereas I've also seen films like The Borrowers and Honey, I Shrunk the Kids and Small Soldiers, where the small things are quite deadly and have much greater force than you would imagine.
Right.
So there's a reasonable answer. Now,
I don't believe in fighting at all.
Really?
Yeah.
What if your life depended upon it? If you or the ducks.
Well, they didn't say that, did they?
Or the horses, I don't know.
This is why I would never... That's a good answer, though. I like that point
And then why is water tasteless? What isn't tasteless? It tastes of water, would be my answer. That's just a dumb question. Do you like to sing? Do you like to sing in a bath? I mean,
who has time to take a bath anymore?
Yeah,
I did the other night.
I do occasionally.
Let's not get weird again.
I prefer to read. A penguin walks through that door right now wearing a sombrero. What does he say and why is he here?
Tequila.
He says, yeah, I want a tequila, please, not a Corona, because I'm worried about the virus. People are actually genuinely not buying Coronas.
I think you need some job interviews because this is priceless. Simon Undercover doing job interviews is a potential podcast I might listen to and subscribe to.
We should do it, but those are ridiculous questions that I would just have no time for.
It's all about,
I didn't get those jobs, by the way.
It is, as Simon says, it's all about seeing how you react under pressure or whether you start, you know, panicking. You go into full panic mode and go, oh, is there a right answer to that? Or is there some way that... you start to overthink it, I think, is what the kind of idea of this is, where you should probably just come up with something a little bit sort of like, you know, that induces some laughter and relieves a bit of the tension rather than getting it all sort of like uppity and sort of, you know, getting kind of like worried about what you're replying. Yeah.
I get the one about the ducks now that you've kind of put it that way, because then you could, if you want to go at like a more serious angle to it, you could say, well, I don't know what fighting ducks would be like, but I do know I've been in situations where you fought one big problem or you fought multiple little ones. And I'll be honest, it's sometimes easier to focus on the big problem and fight that than it is to have loads of little ones. But the
good
penguin,
that is exactly probably
the penguin
right
in the sombrero, I'd be like,
I'll just be worried it's going to die. Doesn't it need to be like in a pool
here?
Of water? It'd probably be too hot.
Right, you know, where's it come from? You know, you just, what's it doing there in a sombrero? But anyway, we digress.
Then, well, you see, another way to answer that question would be to sort of tell the story of how the penguin got there.
Yeah.
Or tell the story of what happens next. Or the
like
man takes off his penguin head because he's in fancy dress and he says, I'm just off to a fancy dress party, can I have a beer first? Or something like that.
Could get really weird, I suppose.
And that's also, I think, to see how weird you are. So if you see if you come up with some absolutely like baffling weird answer that is just beyond the weirder meter, I think it's probably people, you know, it's to
like
see
you
how
said, you know what, that happened to me last week.
And to see how you'd fit
Except
into a team.
Except he wasn't wearing a sombrero, he was wearing a face mask and a bikini.
Yeah, that goes over the weirder meter for me, and I'd be like, not sure how you'd fit into the team.
So the official advice is don't panic, set a scene and show examples.
Oh, yeah. This is the point to this, sorry.
And rehearse, use a bridging question, think about the company's objectives and answer accordingly. I'm not sure how you get the penguin into that one. Be yourself as well.
I think be yourself is the best answer, unless you are weird.
Well, exactly, that's my point. To this person that
and
asked
if you
about
are weird, don't be yourself.
The money, exactly. It was like the advice was just be yourself, and I thought, yeah, generally that's a good piece of advice, but I wouldn't say all the time.
So there is also a concern that questions like this are particularly unfair on some people. So they are easier to answer if you are extroverted and chatty and the kind of person who just makes stuff up as they go along. Whereas for people who are more introverted and more clinical and prefer a scenario where, you know, they've got a quiet space to work and they're more process driven, that it's less fair on them.
Depends what job.
So if
you're
if you are that person, if you are a more introverted person and you are concerned that you're going to go to an interview that has this kind of thing come up, then just be prepared for it. And the best way to be prepared for it is to say, well, actually, that's an interesting question, but it's a difficult one. I just need to think about it for a minute, and then think through in your process sort of system that you like to think through, and then deliver the answer. Much better than panicking.
All right. Well, this isn't one question, as I alluded to in the start, although I think it would be quite a fun question. What do you think is the most iconic car of all time? I think that would be quite... I mean, that's an interesting way to see how someone thinks and what they like, although it might be a bit discriminatory against people that really don't give a toss about cars. But you've got an article on your website, because they have been named, and I was a bit disappointed, Simon, that James Bond's Aston Martin DB5 did not come out at number one. Therefore, I'm wondering how seriously we can even take this list. Although, in a boost for the UK, six of the top 10 are British brands. So reveal all Whose list is this? How did they comply it? What is iconic? What do we mean? Because it's not just how well a car goes or whatever. It's there's so much more to it, like, hence the James Bond link there, I imagine.
What is iconic?
Yeah.
Sounds like one of those interview questions,
doesn't
it?
There you go. See? I told you this is a good one.
Well, iconic doesn't mean that it was the best car ever, that it didn't tick all of the boxes. It means that it stands out in the memory, that it really defined an era or a place or something like this. It's the list of 100 most iconic cars by a public sector members organisation and magazine, Boundless. Now, why is there a public sector and civil service membership club listing the 100 most iconic cars of all time? Well, what you need to do is realise that 97 years ago, when Boundless was set up, it was originally called the Civil Service Motoring Association. So that's the link there. They got some motoring experts to pick the shortlist, and then they asked their members to vote them in order. And the most iconic was the Range Rover, followed by the Aston Martin DB5 from James Bond, then the Jaguar E-Type, and then the Mini. But there were some strange choices on the list. Included on there was the Dacia Sandero, which is a small, fairly nondescript car made by Dacia, which is an arm of Renault. Very, very cheap. So I'm not quite sure why that was on there. And there was also the Skoda Yeti. But, you know, stuff. People make strange choices. My personal choice from this, and my absolute all-time favourite car, is the Jaguar E-Type. That is the one that I would consider the most iconic. There was a couple of cars from films as well. So you had the Batmobile from Batman, you had Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, and you also bizarrely had Brum.
Brum?
Brum, yeah, kids TV car. Oh, and you had Ecto-1 from Ghostbusters. That's a cool car. So I like the E-Type. I love the Lamborghini Countach as well. The Countach is a great example of an iconic car that isn't actually the best car, because they're... I've never driven one, but they are meant to be pretty horrendous and very difficult to drive. And there are lots of cars that are much better than them. But it absolutely defined an era of supercar design and still looks wonderfully mad to this day.
Lee, do you have a favourite?
No, Georgie, I'm not allowed to have a favourite. We're not allowed to like cars anymore because petrol, diesel, you know.
Good point.
You know, I can't possibly comment on this list. All I will say is that at number 13... is the Reliant Robin from Only Fools and Horses.
So Reliant Regal. It's a Reliant Regal.
To prove the point that it doesn't have to be a very good car.
Whatever it is that Del Boy drove, I'm going to pick that because I think that ticks all the boxes. It's iconic. You know exactly... Well, I say you know exactly what it is, but I didn't when you see it. And I think it defines an era.
Marvellous, marvellous.
The Model S, the Tesla Model S is on this list as well, and I think that will go down as an iconic car and a game-changing car as well. So
we shall see. All right, you can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon?
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk if you think there's something that you'd like us to investigate. You can tweet us if you want to tell us about your answer to odd interview questions. Mm-hmm. And you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast where you can join in the debate in the comments.
Marvellous. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.
This Is Money's podcast is brought to you in partnership with the Financial Services Compensation Scheme. Check your financial products at FSCS Protected at fscs.org.uk/thisismoney.